Hello and welcome to the Picture House podcast. My name is Sam Clements and today I'm joined by my esteemed colleague, Karina Andrebus.
Hello, Sam.
This is normally we have quite a big crew, but I quite like today. It's just me and you in the pod booth.
Just chilling.
It's the end of summer.
Yeah, it's too hot anyway. You don't want to fill this pod room with more than two people, otherwise it just gets too hot.
That's true. If it's over 20, it's a two-person job.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a challenging time for cinemas, but it is also a great time for cinemas because air conditioning, the greatest invention.
Yeah, it's the best place, actually. If you think about it, normally everyone's just like, oh no, why would I go to the cinema because it's sunny? But actually, it's the best place. You can get some nice cold drinks, air-conditioned cinema, get to watch a movie. It's great.
It's a fun time. I was recently on holiday and it was so hot on holiday. Like, I like the heat, I like the sun.
Yeah,
but when it was so hot, it was when there was that heat wave in Paris, like in the end of July, it was 40 degrees.
Yeah, that's...
Couldn't do anything.
That's nuts.
Eiffel Tower was just like a giant radiator heating up Paris. Couldn't be done. So I went to a French cinema to watch Toy Story 4. Or Toy Story Catra. And it was really, really good. I had such a good time. And part of my enjoyment was actually just seeking that refuge from the baking heat. I had like an iced coffee. It was wonderful.
You don't need sun cream in a cinema.
This is also true. Although maybe that would be a very responsible thing to do so people can absorb it and then they can go out into the rays. I was in a pub at the weekend and they actually had sun cream for their customers in the beer garden.
That's good.
A responsible pub.
Good PR. Well done.
Have you been to the cinema lately?
I have, actually. I went to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
Uh-huh,
for the second time yesterday at Hackney, after seeing it on 35 at Ritzy. I'm sure we'll come on to that. And yes, I also went to Paris and I went to a beautiful cinema, which I believe is Isabelle Huppert's cinema. I don't know if she actually owns it or if she's a patron
she
of some sort.
She owns it with her son who manages it.
Yeah, it's beautiful. And I saw a glorious Western movie, again on a beautiful 35mm print. Jeremiah Johnson, which I'd never seen before. I'd only seen the gif of him putting up a very erect thumb at a beaver. That sounded much more dirty than it needed to be. But it's a great gif.
I think you leant into it, though.
Yeah, so now I've seen the gif and now I've actually seen the accompanying film.
Oh,
I think
wow,
my life
the
is complete.
The gif. So that's so 2019 of you. I'm going to go and see a movie because it's based on a meme.
Exactly.
I think that's how the emoji movie started. So Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is the reported ninth film from Quentin Tarantino, although I don't think that takes into account the fact Kill Bill 1 and 2 were split in half and he's actually directed other films before Reservoir Dogs. Anyway, it's advertised as the ninth film from Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, and he says he's only going up to 10, right?
That's what he said, although technically he's... had two Kill Bills, and he directed a quarter of Four Rooms, and he directed a film before Reservoir Dogs. Anyway, that's just, you know, semantics.
Yeah.
he's made a big hoo-ha about he's going to make 10 movies and then retire. And
I don't believe him.
I don't know. He doesn't actually make that many films. It's like one every 5 years anyway, so...
Yeah,
he's
but
maybe...
he's not. I mean, after watching Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, he's not letting up steam. He has still got so much passion inside him, and I fear for us all as to what he'll do with it if he can't make movies, because he's a very violent man.
Well, yeah, maybe he'll be playing Grand Theft Auto. I don't know. The romantic idea in my head is that because he always starts writing his scripts as books. He did Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Hateful Eight and all of, you know, he's done it a lot. He talks about often writing his scripts as books. Maybe he'll become like a novelist.
Yeah, but he's a visual artist.
Maybe
think of the bombasticness of all his visual films. Like everything is just so colossal and rich and wonderful. And I mean, how he's going to translate that onto words, maybe he's this amazing poet that we didn't actually know about. But I'm quite happy with seeing his work up on screen. I think he's one of a kind.
It does always feel like an event when there is a Tarantino film. And actually also, as I mentioned before, he does take a while to make his movies. He isn't a production line. He sort of does it when they're ready and he takes a long time shooting them and editing them as well. It's kind of nice to have that wait because you're like, oh, it's an event, a new Tarantino film. We haven't had one, you know, for three or four years. Oh, okay. Mm. And it makes it more of an appointment to view because it does feel like, from what I've seen with Hollywood, it's one to see in the cinema.
Yeah,
and people are
definitely
making a point of going out, seeing it on the big screen. He's almost weatherproof in that respect.
Yes, I think so. I think he's got a lot of privileges that other filmmakers don't necessarily need, such as, you know, he's got all the time that he wants. He's probably got a blank check. Anyone would just write him any amount of money. And he's got the best Hollywood film stars at his disposal. Everyone Absolutely. Wants to work with him, who wants to, you know, be in this whole romance of what Quentin Tarantino brings to the screen. Problematic or not, he always brings dialogue to cinema.
I think he approaches it in a very unique way, and it feels like you get a little window into his brain, into
worryingly.
His very violent and yeah. maybe foul-mouthed brain. But
yeah.
I had the privilege, not to show off, I had the privilege to meet him the other day for a little interview, and he was really, really nice. I was a little bit nervous because it's Tarantino. Mm. He's a big name. I do a lot of interviews, and I don't get nervous usually, but Tarantino,
yeah,
wow,
that's
okay. He's that guy I watched when I was like 12 years old, and you know, like he was one of the first director's name I could probably name. And he did not disappoint. He was a joy, an absolute delight. Mm. We might cut a little bit of that interview into this podcast.
Mm. Well, he liked your T-shirt as well, didn't he?
He really,
no wonder,
really
he wooed you.
Liked my T-shirt. Yeah, I was wearing a T-shirt with some hamsters on, and and he gave a little shout out. Show. I used to be a cinema projectionist. I trained as a 35mm projectionist.
All right, good
and deal. One of the first movies I had to project was Inglourious Basterds.
Oh, excellent.
So cool.
Oh, we were all filmed that time, man, for sure, yeah. Uh-huh.
And we had to move because we had multi-screen, so I had to move it around the cinema, the print made up.
Yeah.
It was quite a hefty print.
Yeah, I bet. Well, especially if you're plattering it.
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So I think it was a bit of a workout.
so you actually moved it to the other screen? You didn't just have it thread through so it played and...
it was an old school pokey cinema,
so we didn't quite
have the interlacing.
Yeah.
I feel like I've seen that film the most of your movies.
Yeah, well, that wouldn't make sense.
And when I sat down to watch this, it was like a hug. We're back. Here we are. This is cool. Quentin Tarantino doing a movie about the movie industry.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah, right from the beginning, it had that little montage of the projectionist threading up 14 Fist of McCluskey.
Which is it's cool. It really sets the mood. And we get to play this film in 35mm in our cinemas, which is quite rare. Which is so exciting.
And thank you for showing it in your cinemas in 35mm. It's great.
How do you feel at this point in the journey? Because you had your premiere in Cannes and it's sort of, you know, had those early, it's open in the US now. So you've got a sense of how people are responding.
Yeah.
And it's about to go pretty big across the UK.
Yeah. Oh God, it's very exciting. I mean, we just finished our opening weekend last weekend, and so I flew in here like on Monday. Oh. And so I spent the whole weekend watching it all over Los Angeles in different neighborhoods and hearing audiences respond to it, and you know, reading all the first the pieces, then the think pieces that came out on the thing by Saturday and Sunday. And it's just very gratifying. It's been in my head for like a long, long time. Mm. So to actually have it get this response and to see like this kind of excitement, and you guys seem to be excited for it, and we had a terrific premiere the other night. So yeah, no, it's just, it's incredibly gratifying.
It's cool. I think like for all of those think pieces and things, actually being with the public
on
the opening weekend, that must be like the part where you're like, yes, this is why I do it.
Well, you know, it is interesting about the fact that it's like... you know, I make movies that journalists can talk about. Well, whether it's you and your friends in a pub talking about it, or like you go see the film and you go and have a piece of pie or something afterwards and talk about it, or it's journalists, good or bad or whatever, like, you know, mulling it over. Mm. So it was interesting about the whole idea that like Thursday and Friday, the different reviews came out, and they might have alluded to something in, as far as the story is concerned, but they didn't spoil anything. They kept it down. But then Saturday and Sunday, there's all these think pieces about the very ending, all right, and talking about it. And some people liked it, and some people didn't, but they're all going back and forth on it. And that was it's just fun to be part of the conversation.
So I guess going way, way, way back to the beginning of this project, can you remember when you first had this idea and when you knew this would be your next movie?
Well, the two things didn't really coincide with each other. Because I worked on this thing for about 5 years. I think I first came up with any initial ideas on it sometime after Death Proof.
Oh, wow.
But I think I started writing on it about 5 to 6 years ago. Mm. And first I was going to write it as a book, so I wrote about 2 to 3 chapters as a book. And then I finally kind of realized I was going to do it as a script, and so I started doing that. And then it was just something that I worked on. I wasn't in any hurry. Mm. It was something I worked on in between projects, and just kind of moved the rock up the hill a little bit more, and a little bit more, and a little bit more, until finally, after Hateful Eight, I started doing that, thinking that that was what I was going to do. And all of a sudden, I was like, I went further than I was going. Oh shit! I'm going to finish it now. This is it. This is okay. Okay. Well, I guess this is what I'm doing. I guess this is what I'm going to do next. Okay. So, okay, get ready. But I wasn't prepared for it to kind of, for like the horses to just start running.
Right.
But they did. And so I was just hanging on. But where the initial idea set in was, I was working with an actor who had a pretty long career and had done a few different action movies. And so, we're working together, and then he goes to me, he goes, you know, Quentin, I do kind of have a stunt guy. Now, I haven't bothered you about it, because I don't think what he does, like, fits in. Mm. But there is one gag that we're doing coming up that would be, that he could do. And if you wouldn't mind, can I bring my stunt guy on? Can we give him that gag? And I go, oh, yeah, sure, sounds good. All right, so he came on, and you could tell that, I think they've been working together for like 11 years or 15 years, something like that. And you could tell that there was a time that you could practically shoot close-ups with the stunt double. Wow. You know, you can imagine him in the outfit with the guy sitting next to each other looking, and just only the actor, the vaguely more handsome one. But other than that, they look exactly alike. Well, that wasn't the case anymore. All right, they had all gotten older and everything, and this was probably one of the last times as they worked together. But it was a very interesting dynamic to see these guys who'd had a 15-year career. And, I've heard, like, Jeff Bridges has his stunt guy, and everyone who has ever worked with Jeff Bridges knows that guy. And then, like, Steve McQueen had Bud Eakins, and Burt Reynolds had Hal Needham. And so I just remember watching these two old duffers sitting on their director's chairs, like they've been doing for 15 years, dressed exactly alike, sitting there talking to each other. And I was like, that's an interesting dynamic. If I'm going to do a movie, and someday I will do a movie about Hollywood, that would be an interesting way inside.
That thing you mentioned about seeing people with their stunt double is one of my favorite things to see on behind-the-scenes shots.
Oh, yeah, I know, me too. Yeah, exactly.
People
yeah.
who almost look just about right.
Yeah, no, you could, like, no, I totally remember, like, yeah, it was like Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones sitting next to Terry Leonard dressed up as Indiana Jones with the hat and the jacket. Well, there was one of the things that was vastly missing from this movie until I added it in at the last minute was we didn't have any shots of Cliff and Rick dressed in the exact same outfit. And the scene where Rick tells Cliff he's going to have to let him go, that was added later because that was actually in narration section. And then Tom Rothman of Sony Pictures said, that's really cool. I don't want this to be narration. I think you should dramatize it. Let's watch Rick say that to Cliff. And I go, okay. And so I wrote it, and I finally had a situation that I could put them both in the same outfits as they have this horrible conversation.
Oh, well, I'm very glad you did.
Thank you, mate. Just to let you know, I think the I think since I've been in England, not this time, but mm-hmm. I mean, since I've been coming for the last 27 years, I guess, I think I've been on three dates in London, and one of them was to Picture House.
Oh, awesome. That's pretty cool, man. So Tarantino has had this idea for a while. He actually started writing this 10 or so years ago, and then other things got in the way. He made Hateful Eight, he made some other movies, but he was always like chipping away at this film. And I feel like this is, of his later kind of output, this is one that feels like a return to form. You know, this feels like a little bit closer to Pulp Fiction, Jackie Brown style Tarantino. Not just because it's now set in LA again, not the Old West, but I think it's got that sort of layered dialogue and these like multiple story strands, which he's quite famous for.
Mm.
Going into this film, do you consider yourself a fan of Tarantino, or were you sort of going just because everybody's going and you need to have an opinion on this movie?
I mean, it's lots of different things. I wanted to have an opinion on it, and I wanted to see what the fuss was about. I think, love or hate him, he is shaping a lot of how we think about cinema, how we think about what's acceptable or not, the boundary pushing of what violence is and representation matters. And also he's a big lover of the film on print, which I personally really enjoy watching film on a print, and the fact that he is still very much a filmmaker. Again, the privilege of being able to work in that way, in that very expensive way, but that very unique and special filmmaking way. And also, yeah, I'm a cinema sucker, and I love people like Brad Pitt and Leonardo DiCaprio, and just to be able to see who I would consider some of the biggest, you know, the true stars of Hollywood right now, side by side, in a very interesting story, which kind of harks back, I can imagine, to some of their own personal sentiments about aging in this machine of Hollywood, and how perfectly cast they are for that.
No, absolutely. I think he's got a real eye for cast. Going back to, like, he basically was responsible for rebooting John Travolta's career with Pulp Fiction. And he often does that. He'll choose, you know, somebody to put them back in the limelight. I think John Travolta has now faded again. You know, he had a good chance after Pulp Fiction. That's nothing to do with QT. It's interesting that Tarantino in this film has gone back to 1969, because that feels like, I mean, that is when Tarantino grew up. That's a lot of his, like, references as a child are from this period, but it feels perfect for him.
It really does. And just from I didn't have the pleasure of talking to him. Just from listening to him talking about how he was harking back to his own history and the things that he remembers driving around. And this is one of the things I actually particularly enjoy about the film, all the driving scenes. So him in the back, or the front of the car, just driving around, and that haziness of the world going by and the radio coming on and not having as many channels to flip onto and not having an iPod or anything like that. It's just out and out radio and the songs that are coming on and the adverts that you're swinging by and all those beautiful typographies in neon lights across the Hollywood Hills. And that imagery is just such a wonderful place to be at that time. And there's a scene when Brad Pitt is just driving, and it's quite a long scene and is just of him driving. And you can tell that that's him just being very romantic about, you know, 1969 Hollywood. It's gorgeous.
I think there's a lot of cinema iconography in here, because we follow Leo and Brad, and they play an actor and a stuntman, and they've primarily worked on television in Western serials and things, and like the Western. And we learn that Leo's character has had a film career before going to TV, and he made war movies. So we get war movies, we get Westerns, and then we get the Hollywood in the 60s. And it's all like this, like, classic, like, cinema iconography, all of these, like, you know, great, as you mentioned, all those neon signs, the big cars. And within the film as well, there's little pockets of other genres. So we get a horror movie for the very first time when Brad Pitt's character goes up to this ranch where the Manson family are living, and it's so tense. It's a little bit like a showdown. It's a little bit like a horror movie. It's a bit like Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I thought people, like, running around these empty buildings, following Brad Pitt through cracks and things and all.
Spooky.
And I quite like that. Even though it is LA, it's Hollywood. He allows himself to go into these various other types of cinema, and ultimately, it's a buddy movie, and it's quite funny.
Yeah.
And I liked that. This feels like one of the most accessible Tarantino films ever.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, one doesn't work with the other, without the other. With Brad Pitt being the stunt double for Leo, Leo's got work, Brad's got work, and it doesn't really work. And in a way, that's quite a nice kind of romance that they've got going there. I do really like the idea of these little, they're quite subtle, but subtle for Tarantino, just the way that he references TV and advertising and all these other influences, visual influences that we are having as a culture that are feeding into the way we are looking at the world. So there's, and this is a bit of a tip, but don't leave straight after the credits, because you get to see an advert later on, and it's Leo depicting an advert for a cigarette brand, and it's hilarious. It's actually really, really funny. Did you see it?
I did.
Good.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you don't look like a man that leaves right after the
No, it's a good point, because no one's mentioned it actually in reviews, but it is worth staying. It's not a Marvel superheroes kind of Avengers type sting, although Sam Jackson, who does those, has been in a lot of Tarantino films. It's actually quite fun, and if you follow the Tarantino lore, there's a few made up brands which are in a lot of his films, and the cigarette brand is Tarantino's brand of cigarettes that he's made up all the way back to, I think, Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
So, well, I mean, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out a couple of weeks ago, but it's still going strong. Highly recommend seeking it out at your local picture house. It's going to be a while before we get another Tarantino film, guys.
Absolutely.
And it could be the last one.
Yeah, so, and if you get a chance to see it on 35, do.
Yes, no, it's been really fun playing this in 35mm in a number of cinemas. So check your cinema listings. It looks beautiful because it was shot on film, but it's like an extra joy to see it on 35 if you can. Okay, so that's currently out.
Gosh, could have talked about that all day.
It's a big one.
Yeah.
Maybe we can come back to it next week.
Yeah, part two.
I've only seen it once, and I feel lacking in that. Like, it definitely... I came out of the film thinking I need to see it again.
Yeah.
I felt like it's
really
rich. It's a world I loved being in, albeit, quite terrifying at times. I would like to go back and maybe just soak in some of the detail. I didn't really notice many of the needle drop sound moments, and he's always famous for having these jukebox soundtracks, and... When I was a kid, I had Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction soundtracks on CD when CDs were a thing. And I didn't want to do that with this film because I didn't really notice it. But I think on a second watch, I'll notice those songs. And maybe I'll listen on Spotify or something.
Multiple viewing, definitely recommended.
Okay, so new films coming to cinemas in September or very end of August. Let's do it again. New films coming to cinemas at the end of August, going into September. We got a couple to talk about today, Karina. First off, shall we talk about Inner the Yard?
Yes, we shall.
Now, this is directed by Peter Weber, who I know from The Girl with the Pearl Earring.
Yeah.
And this is a documentary. I didn't realise he did Docs at all. I was just like, he did the ScarJo
Girl with the Pearl Earring. Yeah, neither did I. It's quite a nice surprise.
So the stars of this film are the artists, Inner the Yard artists. So we got Ken Booth, Winston McAnuff, Kid Asai. Mm-hmm. Have I missed anyone out?
Jar Nine, who's more of a guest appearance later on down the line, but yeah, she's definitely relevant.
I've not seen the film, so I'm going to totally defer to you, but it's what I understand, it's Peter Weber's portrait of this group of pioneering reggae musicians.
Absolutely. You don't need to know that much about reggae to know that these guys really are legends in Jamaica, and if you do love reggae, you're going to absolutely love it. If you don't love reggae, you're about to. You basically have these group of elders who have come together. They're practicing literally in the yard of their house, and you've just got this wonderful collage of jam sessions as they work their way up to a concert in Paris, and it's got a very wonderful send-off once you finally get to that point. But in between that, you get all these wonderful stories ranging from thoughtful and heartbreaking, and you get all the individual stories that the singers have had in their life, which has been a very colourful life. As you can imagine, living in Jamaica and Kingston, which has its all sorts of political histories and joys. But it's all in there, but it's all very relaxed and comfortable, and nothing is sensationalised. And it's a real joy of a movie to get to know the music, reminisce on the music, get to know these people, get to know the power of reggae music and the lyrics, and how kind of right now is the kind of sentiment that we need. There's all this music around, but reggae really is a timeless music genre that we can all learn from when you just actually unpick those lyrics. And they're very simple, and they're very full of love, and they're very full of joy and hope. And you can't help but just bounce out of the cinema afterwards with a big smile on your face. It's wonderful.
You mentioned if you know reggae, you'll know these names already, and you'll probably make a beeline to the cinema to see some of your favourite artists on screen. Mm. But if you don't know reggae, this film is accessible, and it's inspirational. Will you come out with a big list to listen to on Spotify?
100%. Yeah, I mean, it's in tandem with the album Inner the Yard actually coming out as well, so it is accessible to get the album or the vinyl. Ultimately, it's also a bromance. We've got a collection of reggae artists at their prime who, even though they are now venturing into their 70s, they are still as sharp as ever, funny as ever, and they're just having these great jam sessions, yet making wonderful on-point music and sharing it with the world. And their outlook on life is always something that you can take back off. There's real wisdom in all their stories, all their individual stories, which eventually weave into one another. And yeah, you, like I said, you don't have to know anything about reggae music. You don't even have to like reggae music, but you can really get on board with the journey of these guys who are lifelong friends, brethrens, as we would say.
Because we've had a couple of previews. The film is out on the 30th, but we've had a couple of previews already. And we had the big premiere was at Somerset House, an outdoor screening.
That was great.
I imagine the atmosphere there was pretty electric.
It was wonderful. And we had some performances by Winston McAnuff and Jar Nine beforehand. And it just really set the scene. And it was an acoustic set. And they were beautifully sung. And they've got such energy and vibrancy. And everyone was just jamming along. And it really was the perfect way to open that film.
And you've seen the film, you've seen them perform, and you've seen them off stage.
Yeah.
Is there a persona they put on stage, or are they just like that?
They're just like that, 100%. As soon as I met Winston at the backstage of Somerset House, he was just like, yes, and gave me a big hug, told me he liked my outfit. I was quarterly dressed in black, red, green and gold, Jamaican colours, colours of my dad's from Jamaica, and we talked about that. And yeah, they were just so, they were loving it. They, you know, you would think, even though this guy who is, I don't even know how old he is, but he's at least 70, he's not holding up. he is still as sharp as a tack. He is still as vibrant as ever, and he's still just wanting to party as much as any 20-year-old. He's great.
He's very animated on stage from what I've seen.
Yes, very, very animated. Oh, the outfits were so good. I love his little hat. And Jar Nine, she's so eloquent. And she's got so much to say about the power of reggae music and what she can bring to it and what it brings to a culture and to people and what we can learn from it. And she's like, I've just found a new mentor in her. She's just beautiful, and everything she says just makes so much sense. She's great.
She's not of this generation, but she is inspired by these guys?
Yeah, she's younger. She's more, I guess, she might not even be in her maybe 30s. But she in herself is an artist, and she's also a big yoga person.
Okay, that's good. That's well, a side note. Yoga, that's kind of a pretty chill life.
Yeah. I mean, she lives in Jamaica. She's got a reggae career. But I think she's the one that updates it, and she is the one that talks about how no matter how old reggae is, as a, you know, reggae is from the 60s, it still sounds so fresh. And when she's singing new songs now, it could be from any era in the last few decades, and it just still sounds so relevant and so fresh and so joyous for everyone to enjoy.
I'm going to put you on the spot now. Is there one track you'd recommend people seek out?
Yes. Well, I would have to say Ken Booth's Everything I Own. Now, you won't, if you don't know it, you might hear it, and then you'll be like, I remember this song, because it is a absolute banger.
Okay.
You're going to remember it. Like, oh, yeah, I remember singing this one, because I remember singing it. Well, I remember it being played in my household when I was a kid. But then there are so many great tracks on the new album as well. Row Fisherman Row is a great one. And they're real summer tunes. And they just, yeah, they're the songs you want to be playing out your car or playing at a barbecue. They're great.
Okay, there's a couple of song tracks there, listeners, to listen to on the way to see Inner the Yard at the cinema.
Yeah.
I think that'd be a fun thing to do. Hopefully cinemas have the soundtrack in their foyers, and it'll just be a nice place to be.
Yeah.
Okay, well, I'm excited to see that. I know what I'm doing this weekend. Later on in September, we've got another film coming out called The Farewell, which is, I'm really pleased this is finally coming out in the UK, because it's currently on release in the US, and Twitter is all talking about how good it is. We played it at Sundance London, where it won the Audience Award.
Yeah.
After every film, audiences get to vote, and The Farewell won that award, which is very exciting. So this is directed by and written by Lulu Wang, who I think it's her second feature. I did go out of my way to find her first feature, which never got released in the UK. It's not available on DVD or Blu-ray here, but like a nerd, I imported it from America. And so I've got that to look forward to, posthumous. And based on The Farewell, I was like, I need to see more of your stuff. You have one film, it's not available, I'm going to track it down.
Mm.
So I've got that. But
what's it called?
Posthumous.
Posthumous. Okay.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't remember any. Yeah. I mean, I just don't remember anything. I think it played at festivals and then nothing happened.
Okay.
In the UK. So it's really exciting to have The Farewell. So Lulu Wang, she's a Chinese-American filmmaker, and this leans into her heritage. She actually goes back, the protagonist is played by Awkwafina. who lives in the US, and she has to go back to China for a family wedding. And there's a whole lot of cultural drama and comedy around this visit. Turns out her parents don't approve of her lifestyle. Who does? Lots of very relatable stuff. Mm. Lots of awkward family moments. Obviously, a big family wedding means you get the extended family in there who maybe don't know entirely everything what's going on. There's also a bit of drama around the grandma figure in the film, or the Nai Nai. And she's such a good character. The actress who plays the grandmother is wonderful. Yeah. And there's real chemistry between Awkwafina and the grandmother. And that's sort of the core of the story. But the parents come into it, the siblings, the cousins, etc. And it has an awkward wedding scene, which is one of my favourite things to see in cinema.
I can't wait for it. The premise of it sounds so interesting. And I've listened to the podcast of which it has been based on, with This American Life.
Oh, yeah.
So she recorded, talked about this particular cultural thing that they do when that she was talking about how when an elder is ill, they don't necessarily always tell the elder that they're actually ill. So then it essentially becomes this big lie, and not telling somebody that they're ill, even though the whole family knows. But that whole concept just sounded very, very interesting. And I can't wait to see how that pans out, and that relationship between a family where there's the dramatic irony of only certain people in the family knowing this one devastating fact, and that one person that doesn't know is the person that devastating fact is going to happen to. And we all must watch it at the cinema, because she actually was talking, one of the things that I found so fascinating about her and talking to her over at Sundance, she was on a panel and she was saying how she had the option to go with a big streaming provider, but turned it down because she knew that she wanted this story to be observed and enjoyed with an audience. Mm. And that's how she believed that her story should be observed. And she had spoken to, I think at this point, she knew that she could have gone to a streaming platform and being offered more money than she could have imagined, or go theatrical. And she asked her mother, and her mother just said, basically, it's your baby. You have to give it to whoever you think will look after it best. And I think the fact that we're now talking about its theatrical release in cinemas very soon is a really wonderful thing. And it shows that there are people and filmmakers that still want to see things up on the big screen where they belong.
I think that's it's great that, you know, she was in a position where she could choose, but it's also great that she chose cinema because we get to play it in our screens. But I got to see this because it was a festival. It was a packed screening. Lulu was actually there and she did a Q&A afterwards, which was great. But it's a funny film, and I watched it with like 200 other people, and like the screen was electric. It felt so buzzy. And I think that's why it won the audience award, because there was an atmosphere in that screen. There would not be an atmosphere at home on your, you know, probably very lovely television and your sofa watching it with just a couple of other people. It wouldn't be the same. So I think the film knows it's playing to a crowd and, you know, it's just the best way to see it.
Yeah. And isn't that sweet that she got the audience award, considering she had the option to, I mean, unless you're going to bring around 10 mates.
Yeah.
That's just you and your laptop. But yeah, this is great.
Totally. I'm so excited to see it again. I don't want to like jump the gun because it's August, but I'm thinking this is probably my film of the year. It's definitely up there. And I think if I see it one more time, that will cement its position. Okay. But yeah, I think she's fascinating. The story is wonderful. The filmmaking is so good. It's got a great soundtrack. A lot of it is actually shot in China, so there's just lots of on-location photography, which looks wonderful as well. It's like a little holiday. And Awkwafina is got such a screen presence.
Yeah.
Like, we've seen her in Ocean's 8, we've seen her in Crazy Rich Asians, but in this film, starring in this film, rather than being the fun supporting character, you can see she's got chops.
Brilliant.
And I'm really excited to see what she does next. I'm sure she'll still do the fun supporting things, but if she can do a few more starring roles where she gets to flex her acting muscles, that would be ideal. I think she'll win an Oscar at some point. Don't know for this film, but I think Awkwafina's got an Oscar coming her way at some point in the future.
Brilliant.
We should talk about a few one-off events, some special things just at your local picture house. Now, Karina, you saw Midsommar.
I did.
You had a great time.
Comedy
of the year.
Great time. Not the right words I would use, but I loved it. It's one of my films of the year, actually, and I don't like horror films.
Interesting. Yeah. So directed by Ari Aster, who came off of Hereditary, which was such a huge film with Toni Collette, and you know, it was terrifying.
Yeah.
This is kind of the complete opposite, but equally weird and wonderful.
Mm.
Well, it's coming back to Picture House Central in a special director's cut format. Yes. So this premiered in New York at the Lincoln Center as part of a film festival. Ari Aster just revealed he's got this extra cut, which is like 24 minutes long, and it's even more gruesome than that. we've been working really closely with the film's UK distributor, Entertainment Film Distribution, to bring it over to Pitch House Central. So if you liked Midsommar, check out this extended cut. It's a very, very limited run from the 6th of September.
I'm so stoked. I mean, I didn't think it would ever say I want 20 more minutes of that, because it is a bit of an onslaught. But my God, yeah, I think this is incredible. I think it's a wonderful opportunity to really relish some more of Ari Aster's crazy depiction of grief and madness and bad, bad relationships. Because this is based on a relationship that went wrong, which is terrifying. But super stoked.
What does he do when a relationship goes right? Imagine that film. So yeah, no, the reviews were really good, and people saying they preferred the extended cut over the theatrical, which is unusual because sometimes people don't like the extra stuff.
Yeah.
But this is his vision. He wanted this film, so now we get to play it this way, which is very good. So looking forward to that. Also on the 6th, the last time we did a podcast together, we spoke about our first surprise film at Picture House. Our second surprise film is coming on the 6th of September to Picture Houses Across the Land. And all I can say is it's a hot ticket, guys. You got to go and check it out. People loved our first surprise movie, which ended up being Blinded by the Light. Can't recommend this enough. Tickets are only £5 and £8. £5 for
it's
members,
bargain.
£8 general admission. Yeah. Just give it a go.
Yeah.
And I fully endorse it.
I'm a big fan. I love the fact that we did it and it worked, because, you know, when you do something for the first time in a cinema, you think it was like, oh, maybe people might not really get the idea and we'll just scrap that. But people came out in their droves, got great feedback. People loved the film.
All we can say is it's a preview. So hopefully it's something that you haven't seen before. And I look forward to seeing what you think. We are also launching a brand new Vintage Sunday season for September, film noir. How do you feel about film noir?
I don't know. I think I'm about to find out.
Okay. Not something that's on your radar currently.
No, there isn't a film noir that I'm not that in tune with too much film history as much as I should be. And it's the kind of thing that I definitely want to learn a lot more on. I don't know. What would you say is a key film noir film?
Well, I would say Double Indemnity, which is the first film in the film noir season. That's often the one that you watch.
I have seen that at BFI, so there you go. It was a beautiful, beautiful film.
That's often the one that gets shown at sort of film studies courses or et cetera, et cetera. And it's one of the famous ones, which has really punctured culture. You know, like, it's often in film lists.
Yeah.
You know, it was a period of time where people were churning out film noir because it was so popular.
Right.
And not all of them has made it through history. But Double Indemnity is definitely one. Also, Maltese Falcon. So we got Sunset Boulevard in there at the end of the season.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah, which has got some fantastic performances in and definitely worth checking out on a big screen.
Mm.
The photography's great. It's a lovely digitally restored print. So go for that.
So what would you say was the top identifying factor of what a film noir film is?
I don't think there's just one.
There wouldn't be one. As I said, that's like, there's no way there's going to be one, but a couple, what would be some
I mean, the stereotypical thing is, you know, the femme fatale, you know, this a female character who maybe comes under a guise of secrecy or something to rope in usually a private eye or a policeman or a detective or just a general do-gooder. Mm. And maybe things aren't always what they seem with that character. They're quite, the femme fatale character can be quite complicated, not all the time, but if you look through early Hollywood and classical Hollywood for complex female characters, femme fatale is a really good place to start.
Okay.
With that. Also, it was under a time where, you know, you couldn't depict sex or anything on screen, but femme fatales were always very sexy and they sort of used what they could show to allude to that. You know, maybe it's visual signifier, or maybe it's how she stands or how she talks, but it's quite an interesting sort of way to get around the censors with those characters. Usually someone wearing a trilby hat and a big coat, drinking
that's,
whiskey,
that's how I imagine it,
a lot of whiskey, a lot of Venetian blinds, a lot of cigarettes going on there. Now it's definitely like a time gone by. You wouldn't see characters like this. That being said, though, there is a famous kids' film, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is basically a great film noir. It's a wonderful film, and Bob Hoskins plays sort of a more of a knowing kind of gumshoe in that. So that has all of your film noir stereotypes, but they all came from these films from the 40s.
Okay.
because that was my first sort of interaction with this genre. And when I was watching these movies, I'm like, it's like Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Yeah. Okay. Sold.
We're not showing Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which is a great shame because it's such a good film.
We should. Okay,
Jessica Rabbit is probably the ultimate femme fatale.
Oh, 100%. Yeah.
So you're going to buy all the tickets for the film noir season?
All of them, yep.
And I'm going to buy tickets for our next special event, which is the Downton Abbey afternoon tea. So Downton Abbey's been made into a film, right?
Yes,
and
right.
I've never seen it, but I'm going to go and see this film because I want to experience it. I want to see what this cultural phenomenon is. The fact that Downton Abbey gets referenced in Iron Man 3, John Favreau is watching it on TV and it's a shout out in a Marvel film. It means this has gone big.
I didn't know that. This is a huge thing. Yeah.
So now they're coming back for a film. It's apparently set after the TV show, and we're celebrating this return with a special afternoon tea screening. So your ticket for this film event on the 15th also includes cake, sandwiches, scones, tea, coffee, etc.
Can I just come for that?
No, you have seen the film.
Oh, okay.
It's a strict policy.
Okay.
It's all or nothing.
Okay.
Approach.
That's a bribe. Come and watch it, and we'll give you a cucumber sandwich.
Well, don't take it. I mean, that speaks to me. What more do you want?
All right.
I'll sit through anything after a cucumber sandwich.
True.
So yeah. So
no, I'm intrigued. I'm very interested to see how this one pans out. I'm aware it's a big cultural institution.
I know people love it, and I know some people hate it.
Yeah. it's going to tap into a whole different market and audience of people that might not necessarily come to the cinema because they've been sitting and watching TV with a cup of tea and a biscuit. And I'm all for it. If it bridges that gap, bring them in.
Absolutely, I'm intrigued.
And in addition to afternoon tea, did you know we're also launching a new refuge campaign, which I'm really excited about. Makes a lot of sense to me. Every cup of tea we sell at all Pitch House cinemas, whether it be your Builders, your Herbal Infusions, whatever it is in between, we will give 10p to our charity partner, Refuge, who raise money for women and children at risk of domestic abuse.
So you don't have to do anything extra. Just come to the cinema, buy a cup of tea as you would usually,
and
money goes to charity. That's a great thing.
Absolutely.
It should be good. I think we looked at tea because it's actually one of the most popular items at Pitch House Cinema. So like, how could we raise the most money? Let's go for the most popular item we sell, tea.
Yeah.
Very British.
And, British.
So yeah, all of those proceeds will go to Refuge, which is wonderful. Well, there we go. What a packed month coming up. September's going to be great.
Yep, it's
There's
good.
A whole bunch of films we didn't get to talk about. So we'll come back in the pod booth. We'll talk about It Too. We'll talk about The Last Tree.
Oh God, It Too.
And we'll have a...
I saw the trailer for that yesterday. Oh, I don't know if I'm going to see that.
For the sake of the pod.
Stick an afternoon tea in, then I'll be...
I'll get you a cucumber sandwich.
Then I'll be lured.
So we'll be back for that. We can at least review the catering, if nothing else.
Yeah.
That would be wonderful. So thank you so much, Karina, for joining me today
to talk
about these movies. Thank you, listeners, for listening. Really appreciate that. Happy cinema going. And a big shout out to Silk Factory, proud supporters of the Picture House podcast. We love making podcasts here, and it's really great to have them involved, powered by film fans as well. I love chatting to the guys who work here about movies. If you don't know, Silk Factory are an awesome film marketing and creative agency making the coolest trailers and creative content out there. You can check out their website at thesilkfactory.co to see all of their great work. We'll be back in a couple of weeks. See you then. Goodbye.
Bye.